Welcome to the third and last part of Chapter 3 of our series, trying to answer the question, are we heading to a dystopian future? In this part, we will try and reach some conclusions about Brave New World by Aldous Huxley. If you haven't seen or heard Parts 1 and 2, you might want to go back and watch them. Also, this would be a perfect time to give this a thumbs up and maybe share it with someone, or even use the links in the description to buy the book off Amazon or Audible and support my work. And with that, let's start our conclusion. Brave New World is a highly complex book to summarize regarding its underlying political meaning or what kind of cautionary tale it's trying to tell. Given it was written and published at the height of fascism, I'm sure Huxley had these regimes in mind. You should remember that at the time, the elites of liberal democracies in the UK, the US, and others revered Hitler, Mussolini, and the totalitarian fascist state. The notion of an all-powerful elite controlling an all-powerful state definitely gave some elites a major intellectual boner. Don't believe me? Ask Herbert Hoover. So, the fear of something like that being around the corner would surely be on Huxley's mind. Speaking of Mussolini, I have to quote something he said which I think is even more critical to my point. In the following bit, Mussolini describes what he calls super-capitalism, and I quote, "At this stage, super-capitalism finds its inspiration and its justification in a utopia, the utopia of unlimited consumption. Super-capitalism's ideal is the standardization of the human race from the cradle to the grave. Super-capitalism wants all babies to be born exactly the same length so that the cradles can be standardized and all children persuaded to like the same toys. It wants all men to don the very same uniform, to read the same book, to have the same tastes in films, and to desire the same so-called labor-saving devices. This is not the result of caprice. It inheres in the logic of events. For only thus can super-capitalism make its plans." End quote. I think this is precisely what Huxley was thinking about when writing his book. Obviously, Huxley was no fascist, but these ideas were floating around at the time at many circles of society. No less interesting is the invocation of Ford. This might surprise many, but Henry Ford was one of the biggest supporters of the Soviet Union. Indeed, in 1929, Ford invested hefty sums in establishing Ford plants in Soviet Russia. Putting all of the above together is, I think, enough to point to what Huxley sees in his mind when thinking of the governing system of the world state and its society, especially if you add the neo-Marxist or cultural Marxism critique of early 20th century modernity, which has its roots in the same period in the Frankfurt School. The Frankfurt School gives us the first overt criticism of materialism, consumerism, pop art, and the like, which Huxley seems to echo in his book. However, I would argue that this is more of a liberal conservative critique rather than a neo-Marxist or a fascist one. Allow me to explain. The world state is a horrific mix of all the scientific, ideological, moral, political, and economic systems of modernity, except for liberalism and democracy. Remember that Huxley explicitly mentions liberal parliamentarian democracy as being opposed to brainwashing techniques such as hypnopedia. Huxley also laments, through John the Savage, the loss of Shakespeare's classical works, the abolition of the Bible and spirituality, the absence of the nuclear family, and so on. Furthermore, Huxley warns us of the dangers of scientific advances and cultural revolutions, all of which are conservative ideas par excellence. Conversely, individualism, parliamentarian representation, social mobility, and the such are the quintessential concepts of liberalism. Importantly, in Britain, at the time, conservatism and liberalism were fused into a coherent political system, with both unionist liberals and anti-socialist liberals leaving their party and joining hands with conservatives. Therefore, I think it's safe to assume that the book is a liberal-conservative critique of society, emphasizing the paramount importance of individual freedom and cultural heritage. However, since the book deals with aspects of multiple ideologies, I assume Huxley knew that people of different persuasions might focus only on the socio-political aspects of the groups they oppose. Therefore, to assure the reader this is a comprehensive critique of modern society as a whole, Huxley is very particular about the names of his characters. Fordism, as I've mentioned, is an obvious pointer to mass production and consumerism. Ford is revered almost as a god in the book, and his principles of mass production are a form of religion. Ford's name is a substitute for God on nearly every other page, with phrases such as "O Ford," commonly uttered by citizens. Interestingly, his name is replaced with Freud when dealing with psychology. In case you didn't know, Freud had just as much influence on neo-Marxists as Hegel did. Speaking of psychology, which plays a significant part in the book, the emotional engineer's name, Helmholtz Watson, is comprised of the father of behaviorism, John B. Watson, while his first name refers to Hermann von Helmholtz, a German physicist and physician who made breakthroughs in physiology and psychology of visual and auditory perception, turning it, in a way, from qualitative experience to a quantitative one. Bernard Marx, Lenina, and a little girl called Polly Trotsky are obvious pointers to command economies, socialism, and communism. Bernard's first name probably refers to the socialist playwright Bernard Shaw, who saw totalitarianism and even genocide as justifiable means to attain a communist utopia, and saw eugenics favorably. In fact, while most old world works and writings are banned by the world state, George Bernard Shaw's works were, and I quote, "one of the very few whose works have been permitted." A character named Benito Hoover is an unmistakable mix of the fascist Benito Mussolini and Herbert Hoover, the US president at the time, who famously saw an economically interventionist state within a capitalist framework. The character of Darwin Bonaparte is another evident mix. Darwin is the prime example of the supremacy of science over religion, and in Huxley's time, he would have also been closely associated with eugenics. Bonaparte refers to Napoleon Bonaparte, the autocratic emperor of the totalitarian French Republic, a state formed from trying to forcibly implement what can only be described as oppressive liberalism. Mustafa Mond the highest-ranking official in the book, is a mix of Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, a prime example of a secular nationalist, and the British Zionist Sir Alfred Mond, Zionism too being a secular nationalist movement. And there are many more examples such as these. This type of overall critique might be why the world depicted in Huxley's Brave New World seems to have many parallels to our society. After all, the social, political, and economic fabric of the West today is woven from the same strings of thought that gave rise to society at Huxley's time. Therefore, I would also caution people from seeing the world state as a cautionary tale of a world government. Instead, I think it is Huxley's attempt to tell us that all states are affected by the same themes he warns us of. All of the above, therefore, makes Brave New World much more in line with society today compared to Orwell's 1984. But suppose we are to make conclusions about our society's unavoidable doom. In that case, we should notice closely what he's warning us of, which, summed in two words, is uncontrolled progress. Now, if you have listened all the way through, I hope you will check the description to find ways to support my work, or at least give a like and a share. And with that, remember, don't do to others what is hurtful to you. Don't let the bad guys win, and thanks for staying to the end. See you in the next chapter.